name is Anya Viktorovich, and this is Rescue Radio by Portland Mountain Rescue.
Hi, friends. Conducting helicopter rescues is inherently dangerous. In the heat of the moment, there isn't much time to consider your options. Conditions may not be optimal, with crews under pressure and lives on the line. Today, I invited Eric Gagnon from the King County Sheriff's Office, who is in the helicopter rescue unit. Hi, Eric.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. So today I ask Eric to talk about what it takes to do a helicopter rescue and why you can't always expect one. Eric, before we start, can you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Yeah, I've been in search and rescue for about 25 years. I actually got my foundation in the Coast Guard. I was in for 10 years in small boat search and rescue units. Then when I became a member of the sheriff's office, about a year after I was hired, I started doing ground SAR and then was invited to transition over to the helicopter rescue side. And I've been doing that ever since. And currently, I'm part of the training cadre that teaches new members how to conduct the rescues. So not flying, everything behind the pilot and the co-pilot.
Awesome. Thank you. So I asked Eric to bring us an exciting story from one of his rescues just to start us off. I know you talked to me about the rescue that happened, what was it, a couple of years ago?
Yeah, it was about 10. It was in 2014, and it was up in the Elpental Basin off of Chirpete.
Okay, so tell us what happened, because I thought it was exciting.
Well, I can't do that. It was a dark and stormy night, because it really wasn't. It was a beautiful, warm September day, and we got called for a climber that had fallen on Chirpete. And Chirpete, for those of you who might not be familiar with it, it's about 6,200 feet. It's a class 3-4 scramble. So not particularly difficult, but it's very picturesque, beautiful, and it has a lot of, it gets a lot of use because of all those things that I just mentioned. We got dispatched up there as the rescue unit, as an air rescue unit, because a climber had fallen and injured their hands and their arms to the point where they were not able to safely descend. It was towards the end of the day, so there had been a lot of solar heating on both sides of the slope. And we knew that if we didn't go up there and do the rescue, that it was probably going to take a ground rescue team until the next day to lower her down. And we accepted the mission and we flew up there. As luck would have it, for anybody that's in the helicopter world, you know, the number one thing that always throws a wrench in the system is weather. Even though it was a warm September day, we were dealing with really bad mushy air right at the peak where we had to hover, mainly because of the updrafts that were coming up on either side of Chirpete and converging basically right where we needed to hover. Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah. We had made several approaches trying to find a place where the helicopter was happy. We finally found an approach that seemed as good as it was going to get. And I was lowered down to the patient. And it was, our plan was, we had good communication with the party that was up there. And we knew that could probably use the patient's harness as opposed to having to put her in one of our pieces of rescue equipment. And why that is important is because we're trying to minimize the amount of time that we're exposed to that high level of risk in when we're in a hover with somebody on the end of the cable. If we can get that down to as short amount of time as possible, that is better for everybody involved. So they lowered me down. I did a quick check on the patient's equipment, and it was good to go. I hooked into her harness and we lifted off. As we started going up to the helicopter, I think the hoist was probably around maybe 190 feet. And as we started going up, the pilot lost his stable hover and the helicopter did kind of a tail rotation. Probably, I would guess it was probably somewhere between 90 and 180 degrees, somewhere in that area where the helicopter effectively, I can just say, spun around. You know, because of physics, that spin is then induced to me and the patient on the end of the cable. So we get this large oscillation. And eventually what happens is that the hoist operator is trying to control it, but the oscillation comes around and causes the cable to get stuck between the skid and the skid guard. And so the skid guard is a piece of heavy-duty plastic that's meant to protect the cable from direct contact with the metal skid. And in this case, it caused more issues than what it was designed to prevent, because the cable was jammed so tightly between the skid and the skid guard that the hoist was not able to pull it free. The hoist operator, he was eventually able to push it out, physically push it out. That whole incident that happened caused the hoist cable to fray. We're not talking, you can just think about this for a second. You have a hoist cable that's slightly smaller than the diameter of a number two pencil that me and a patient are riding on the end of it. And now you can degrade that even farther, the strength of that cable even farther, because we have frayed the outer sheath of that cable. I think that when we replaced the cable, I might get corrected on this, but I think that there were 18 individual wires that had been parted on the sheath of the cable. God. Yeah. So
were you able to see what was going on? Or?
I knew something wasn't right. Number one, any unwanted movement, like those big oscillations or swings on a hoist, that's an in-flight emergency that we need to take care of. So that's the first indicator that things were not going well. The next thing was when we stopped, hoist cable stopped, and I looked up the hoist cable. Normally, it's this perfectly straight. That's almost like a rod that goes all the way up to the hoist. Well, now it goes up to the skid and then makes an angle and goes over the hoist. So I knew that was a problem. And then the hoist operator, when he was trying to free that cable, which I could go down a whole different rabbit hole about whether or not that was a wise thing to do, trying to free the cable. But as he was trying to free that cable, he was kicking it, and he kicked it three times. And that I can feel that on the end of the cable. Mm-hmm. That is also our emergency breakaway signal. So let's say I'm down on the hook and I'm in the trees and the cable gets wrapped around a tree and they can't free it. They're going to kick the cable three times to alert me that they're getting ready to cut it so that I can either grab onto the tree or get ready to go for a little bit of a ride. And so when he kicked that, the first thing that goes through my head is, why is he going to shear the cable on me? This is not approved. So to answer your question, I was very aware that this was an in-flight emergency and incredibly precarious position that I was in. Thankfully, the hoist operator was able to free the cable. He spooled the cable into the hoist after about three wraps. After that frayed portion goes into the hoist, after about three wraps, it's not under that much load anymore. And then he brings me into the helicopter. And I don't think that the patient ever knew what was happening, but we were able to deliver the patient down to a waiting ambulance, and then we flew home, and we had a very intense debrief over the last, or you know, over several days, and came up with some new emergency procedures, some training deficiencies that we exposed during this. And thankfully, I'm here telling you the story.
I just have to say, I'm glad they didn't cut the wire, and I'm glad you're here. And I'm also very, very like surprised that you're still doing this.
Yeah, I think that anybody in mountain rescue, we could say, you know, in first responder world in general, but we'll just stick with mountain rescue, does it for a lot of like very personal reasons. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're maybe not the same for each individual, but to do that type of work, you know that you have to have a deep reason for doing it. We expose ourselves to life-threatening situations voluntarily to help out our fellow humans. And I would just sum it up in a simple phrase that it is therapy for rescuers to do that. And as hard as it is for some people to understand that, that's where it falls for me.
It's
my way of paying back.
Yeah, great. Wow. Okay. So now after hearing that story, I think it would be good to know what it takes to do a helicopter rescue. Eric, can you walk us through what it takes? from the very beginning, since the injured party calls 911 to where you get to the injured party, because there's tons of logistics that go into play. Who makes decisions and how it all looks like, weather-wise, equipment-wise, people-wise? Can you talk us through this?
Sure, absolutely. So, you know, the 911 call comes in, or it could be, you know, any of the satellite communication devices. It could be a call through the State Department of Emergency Management. You know, it all starts with somebody at the scene being able to get some type of communication out. Most of the time, the first person that sees that call after the dispatcher is a search and rescue with the local sheriff's department. And they make an assessment based on the facts that they have in front of them, whether or not this is a helicopter rescue mission. And if they say, yep, this is it, they don't just shut down all the ground resources. They push ground resources simultaneously with a helicopter, because helicopter rescues are notorious for not going well. Just in general, there's a lot of moving parts involved. When they determine that it's going to be a helicopter mission, they get a hold of the on-duty pilot. Now, this is just our agency. And the pilot does a quick assessment based on their pilot eyes. They look at the weather. They look at where we're going, the terrain features, the type of injuries involved, all of those things. And then once they accept the mission, you know, they have to meet, like, you know, we're not going to go launch if our visibility is poor, you know, the winds are too high, you know, we won't even launch on stuff like that. But once they make the decision that they're going to take the mission, they page out crew. We all respond down to the hangar. And a crew is comprised of a pilot, a tactical flight officer, which is the left seat, who's also a pilot, but their responsibility is navigation, communication, and kind of a backup on mission incident command type duties to the pilot. And then in the back of the aircraft, we've got the system operator, two rescue specialists. Those are the ones that actually go down on the hook. And then a paramedic / rescue specialist that will also go down on the ground. So we all come into the hangar and we'll get a quick mission brief on what it is. We'll start prepping our individual stuff. So like medics will prep the medical gear, you know, their controlled narcotics and all the other things that they bring along. The hoist operator's responsible for everything in the back of the helicopter. So they pre-flight all the equipment. The rescue specialists get themselves personally prepped for whatever conditions they're going down on. So if they're going down into avalanche terrain, you know, they're getting, you know, beacon probe shovel, they're getting whatever flotation, whether it's snowshoes or skis or whatever else, they're getting all that stuff ready to go. And then we'll all kind of reconvene at the end and go over like a final, okay, this is what we're doing. Everybody's prepped and checked. And we have this overall, in the aviation world in general, it's known as crew resource management. What it boils down to is, in the helicopter crew, at any time that there's anybody uncomfortable with the mission or the evolution that we're going to complete, they can call and abort. And we will not ask questions. We're not going to second guess anybody. We will abort. We will fly away or not even take off and reassess once we're not exposed to whatever danger that we're exposed to. That last mission brief before we leave the hangar is our opportunity to voice, you know, hey, I don't like this. We need to do something to try to mitigate X risk or Y risk. Once we make it through that, then we actually will go take off and go fly out to the mission. And, you know, we're very conscious of our systems approach, so that in the helicopter aviation world, the risk for doing something wrong and having a catastrophic failure is so high that you can't afford to make those little mistakes. Because if you make even a few little mistakes, all of a sudden you have a perfect scenario for a catastrophic failure in your mission. And so when we're flying out there, everybody's constantly going over their job in their head. You know, as a hoist operator, I'm sitting there thinking about all of the steps that I've got to take. The medic is going to go out the door and he's going to be thinking about exactly what equipment he's bringing with him and what he's going to do when he gets on the ground. And then when we come into the actual rescue area, you know, we'll make contact with ground crews through the radio and try to get a last minute update. We'll do a high reconnaissance flight and then a low reconnaissance flight. You can look at it as a macro hazard identification and then a micro hazard identification. We'll come in, we'll do performance checks with the helicopter, make sure we have enough to hover and do what we need to do. We complete our on-scene checklist and we go to work. I just used a lot of oxygen explaining all of that. But
so high reconnaissance, is it where when you come in and take a look and then you fly away. Because I've been on the rescues when we were waiting for a helicopter, they would show up like, yay. And then we see them fly away and we're like, oh no, they're not coming.
That's exactly what's happening. Yeah, okay. That's exactly what's happening. And I think every agency out there probably has a little bit different, you know, the ingredients of that high recon flight. It might be a little bit different, but in general, that's what they're doing. They're flying in and this is their first look at the scene, their first exposure to the conditions. They make that flight, they'll fly away and then come back in on that low reconnaissance where we're looking at a lot more of the micro stuff, things like hazards that we could knock down because of our rotor column, you know, snags, rocks, stuff that we could put airborne, sleeping bags, Mylar blankets, you know, even people just standing on the edge of rocks and stuff, taking pictures with their phones, you know, just identifying all that little stuff before we actually come in on our final approach where we have somebody hanging out the door.
How can the injured party help the rescuers?
A lot of times we go down with a very small crew. You know, we might have one person, maybe two on the ground. If we have to do any type of patient movement, it's really, really difficult to do that with only two people, especially if you're in any high angle terrain. Our favorite, to be perfectly honest, missions are when we fly in and Mountain Rescue's been on scene for several hours because they have everything completely wired tight. We basically come in, snatch up the patient and fly away. So for the outdoor recreationalists, my recommendation is don't get caught up in the moment because there's a helicopter overhead and it's really, really hard. I even get excited when I'm outside and I'm looking at the helicopter, but try to focus on being an extra set of hands to the rescuers on the ground. Try to minimize the amount of time that you're videotaping with your phone, you know, just because it's you tend to have this
Instagram story.
Right. I mean, I get it. People want to have something to remember the occasion by. But,
yeah.
You know, it does take your focus away from what we're trying to accomplish, which is trying to bring an injured person out of the mountains. We are very fortunate, I think, in Pacific Northwest, because a lot of our backcountry users, especially the ones that we go out on helicopter rescues for, are very trained and experienced. And so we'll show up and we'll have somebody that will give us a full patient report. They will, you know, when we start doing patient movements, you can tell that this is not the first time that they've ever helped do that. They're very conscientious about things like anchors, loose equipment. You know, no situation is ever the same, but having the training in advance will make it better for the patient and better for the rescuers as well, because we're not starting right from square one when we get down there. You know, we're starting from where that person with the training left off.
So just any wilderness medical training would be super helpful.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, I'm a big proponent of, number one, enjoy the outdoors, but have the training, get the proper equipment and know how to use it. So when we talk about training, get the woofer training. If you are going to be in avalanche terrain, go through avalanche courses. There's so many outdoor safety courses that are available, well worth the investment. I'm going to throw a plug in for search and rescue. If you're really into it, get hook up with a search and rescue organization somewhere, because then you're really going to get the best training available to perform this type of work. But those skills that you have out in the mountains, they don't just live in the mountain environment. It will help you throughout your world, your life in general, because of the decision-making repetitions that you have to go through. So getting that training, getting the right equipment, having the 10 essentials, that's probably the short answer to your question.
Eric, do you want to mention, when we talked last week, you talked about signaling, so people like shining their light.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a really, when you're looking for somebody from the air in the mountains, it is really hard to find people. Especially in the Pacific Northwest because of the trees, 200-foot canopy. You know, having bright colors, reflective equipment is really, really helpful. But to be honest, the most helpful thing, and this works at night and in full sunlight, is you can go on Amazon and you can find a really bright strobe light, as bright as you can find it. We can see a strobe light from miles away, even in the middle of the day when there's direct sunlight on us. And it's incredible. That's probably the easiest piece of equipment to carry, because you can get a strobe light, you know, the size of a roll of quarters, you know, a little flashlight that has maybe 1,000 lumens that has a strobe setting on it. That doesn't add a lot of weight to your pack, but it's very, very effective. So my number one, in fact, that's how we signal. If the helicopter loses our position, let's say we moved a patient and now they can't quite find where we are, we use a strobe light.
Awesome. What's the highest that you've been on a rescue? Do you know?
I think it was Mount Stewart. I think it was probably right around maybe 9,200 feet, somewhere in there. And that was for a couple of ice climbers that fell and landed on the glacier up there. Yeah.
And then, so what kind of helicopters do you use for search and rescue?
Right now we're flying UH-1 Hueys. We have two of them. They are very well-maintained workhorses from the 1960s. Actually, ours are from the 1970s. They're great. They're really great. But as one of our pilots said, I think this is how he said it, these helicopters were designed with a slide rule in the 1950s, and ours are the 1970 models. We're still flying them today. They're awesome. I don't ever want to say that they're not a capable aircraft. I think that technology has come a long way since then, and maybe someday we'll be flying a brand new twin engine rescue helicopter.
But they're getting the job done, so
they are.
Eric, I have a couple more questions here. What does it take to become a helicopter rescuer? If somebody who's listening out there and he's thinking, cool, I want to hang from the frayed wire one day, what needs to be done?
Yeah, so there's a lot of volunteer organizations out there, I think, that have inroads with helicopter rescue units. For us here in the King County Sheriff's Office, the rescue specialists and the hoist operator they come from within the department. Typically, we will recruit from a pool of people that have, number one, a passion for the outdoors, and number two, the willingness to put the time into the training. Training is done in a combination of in-house and through outside vendors. And we start out with training everybody after the selection process. So the selection process is just like any other selection process, where you put in an application, you come in for an interview, there's a skills portion, and then after that, then you're selected or not. And then you start your training. And so the training, we start everybody out as a rescue specialist, learning how to safely ride the hook, getting in and out of the aircraft, touching down on the ground. They have a lot of ability to control how stable their flight is through the air. You know, sometimes people think that, you know, what can you actually do when you're on the end of the cable? I mean, there is quite a bit that you can do to make your life a little easier. You know, there's a lot of medical training that our partner, King County Medic One, provides, a lot of rescue training. And we're blessed because we have some very experienced mountaineers on our crew that we can draw from for instruction, both on the Medic One and on the Sheriff's Office side. And so once we completed the training curriculum for a basic rescue specialist, which takes about a year, you know, we'll sign that person off, and then they're good to go on flights as a primary rescue specialist. After you've been a rescue specialist for 2, 3, 4 years, depending on, you know, what your career goals within the unit are, we'll start the same training process for being a hoist operator. So the hoist operator, obviously, they're the ones that are running the hoist. But you can think about a helicopter mission as a, like, passing the baton of leadership around, depending on where you are in the missions. When you fly out there, you know, in route, it's the pilot's baton. Then he's going to pass the baton back to the hoist operator. And then eventually that baton gets passed to the rescue specialist. But the hoist operator and kind of slash crew chief is responsible for everything behind the pilot, you know, in that cabin. So we want to be very, very certain that that hoist operator has the training and the repetitions to prevent mistakes. Mm-hmm. It's easy to learn the systems that we follow, but in the heat of the moment, moment when your adrenaline is up, the exposure to risk is really high. We want to make sure that basic skill level is not degraded. And so we'll put a lot of time into developing crew chiefs, hoist operators. And once we put somebody in a hoist operator position, they kind of, for the most part, relinquish their rescue specialist duties just because it requires a lot of time to be really good at being a hoist operator. And then after that, you're a full part of the crew and you get to go on all these fun missions all over the Pacific Northwest, which is, it's fun to go see all the beautiful terrain and everything. But honestly, the best part is like we get to bring people back. There's nothing that compares to it, really.
Well, that seems pretty intense, but it's totally worth it.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, it is. It's a long program, absolutely. But I think that through the selection process and bringing in the right people, you don't have... like the training is intense, but you don't have to provide the motivation. These people are extremely motivated and extremely hardworking, and it's basically just feeding it to them as fast as they can take it. Quality of people that are drawn to this type of work is really not just helicopter rescue, but I would say like rescue in general is really incredible because of their motivations to do it. And mm-hmm. So we get to be with the best humans. In my opinion,
takes a special kind of people to do that. So when you were talking about how you go out on the mission, how many people are on standby? Like, are you on call or how does it work?
Yeah. So
do you have like a group of people that they have to be on standby or like, is it like the whole pool of people that you just call?
Yeah, it's for our unit. We have full-time pilots. So during the work week, we have pilots down at the hangar that are flying patrol. They're out flying air support for normal law enforcement activities with a different helicopter. They're not flying Hueys for that. When a call comes in for a rescue, half the crew is already there at the hangar and the other half is typically on duty somewhere else within the county. So they'll just respond down to the hangar. When it's during the off hours or on the weekend, or at night, there's an on-duty pilot that will respond to page. And then we use a paging application with their mobile phones that goes out to everybody in the crew. And, you know, it'll just say something simple like, you know, we have a hoist rescue for an injured climber, Clellan Butte, need a hoist crew and a medic. And then we'll call in and it's first come, first serve to whatever pilot's putting together that mission. And then we respond from home. And I wish we were like, Chamonix, where we lived in a hangar and jumped in a helicopter and went and did hoist rescue missions in 30 minutes. But for us, we can expect from the time the pilot gets the page till the time we're rolling out the helicopter, getting ready to take off, we're already at 60 minutes, maybe even a little bit longer. And depending on where we're going, you know, we might be from page to being on scene. I mean, if we're really pushing it, we could be there within 2 hours.
Don't count on that.
don't count on it. Yeah, exactly. I mean, by the time we get there, most time that golden hour is long gone.
Yeah.
There's no question about it.
Any parting thoughts for our listeners out there?
Ooh, well, we talked earlier about getting the training and having the right equipment, the 10 essentials. You're not just doing that for the safety of yourself or for your climbing partners, your fellow outdoor recreationalists. You're doing it for the rescuers that are coming in as well, be that on the ground or in the air. And, you know, we all like to believe that we can do these rescues and mitigate each and every risk that comes to us. But in reality, nature will not allow that to happen. When it comes to helicopter rescue, we want to help you, but we also want to go home at the end of the day. And so we're going to do everything that we can to balance both of those aspects. Just the basic line that I have for everybody that's out there listening is enjoy nature, carry the 10 essentials, get the training, go with a partner, let people know where you are. And you're going to have a lot of years out there living life in the mountains.
Excellent. And if you think you got what it takes, you can join search and rescue team and
100%
live your best life.
100%. Yeah. And yeah. I, like I said before, I threw in that plug. I mean, it doesn't matter what you're into. 4x4s, there's a spot for you. If you're into horses, there's a spot for you. If you're into mountaineering, same thing. You want to fly drones, there's a place for everybody. And if you want to get into that world, I highly encourage it. It's very, very rewarding. Go for it.
You do meet some incredible people too. Yeah, that's how I met Eric. Incredible. Well, Eric, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking to you. I really appreciate what you're doing.
Same.
Please stay safe out there. No more frayed wires. Gosh.
Thank you very much for having me on your show. I think this is really, really valuable, what you do. And thank you for being a volunteer, a badass mountain rescuer.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you for listening. We really appreciate you. You can check us out at pmru.org. We are also on Facebook and Instagram under Portland Mountain Rescue, where you can find lots of useful information like current mountain conditions and other public education news. A huge shout out to our editor, Mari Feher, for making us sound great. Until next time, and play safe.